The following is a lecture by Rabbi David Kaplan. Rabbi Kaplan is originally from Chicago. He attended Northeastern University and received his rabbinical ordination in Jerusalem. He has lectured widely in Israel and America and is currently a senior lecturer at the main campus in Jerusalem.
Speaking about Torah study, those of you that were here yesterday, just to finish up, so we're talking about the importance of Torah support, of supporting the Torah in the mitzvah, that somebody who supports Torah study, he is credited with the mitzvah as if he has actually studied Torah when he is supporting somebody and making it possible for that person to study Torah. Now, I told you the Talmud says that, first of all, in the section of Talmud, while we're on the subject, you've heard of what's called the Agadah. It's the non-halachic sections of the Talmud. I mean, the Talmud is broken up into two basic sections. You have the halachic sections, what we usually study in the Gemara Shiurim here, and then you have what's called the Agadah sections. The Agadah is the moral and ethical teachings of the Talmud as opposed to the halachic teachings, the more precise halachic teachings which are codified in Shulchan Aruch. You have all these areas of Talmud which are agadic in nature, right? Now, the Agadah makes use liberally of allegories, parables, and various comparisons which the sages have made. There is a major debate among the commentaries whether or not the stories in the Talmud, the guys in our Gemara Shir, you've seen some of the stories about the snake with the seven heads, and there's stories about the supernatural and spirits and demons and so on and so forth. There's a major debate among the commentaries whether or not the stories you find in the Talmud are to be taken literally as well as allegorically, or whether or not the stories are only allegorical. That means when you study, you will find some stories in the Talmud. You look at the story, it looks like something, pardon the comparison, it looks like something out of Sinbad. Right? They talk about monsters and sizes, and right? Everybody agrees there's allegory. The question is whether there's also a literal meaning or not. That's a dispute among the commentaries. Now, yesterday we had mentioned that one of the sages said that there was a giant frog, right? This frog was so big, it was the size of the city of Hagrunya. It's the name of the city. And this city of Hagrunya was made up of 60 houses, 60 buildings. This frog was swallowed by a snake, and then the snake became swallowed by some type of bird called a pushkansa. Pushkansa, we translated roughly, as a raven. Then the raven swallowed up the snake, which had swallowed the frog, and the raven went over, and it flew over, and it sat on the branch of a tree. And the sage says, look at it, the Gemara says, look at the strength of that tree. Look how strong that tree must have been to be able to hold up this bird that's had a rather satiating meal. And then Rav Papa says, if not for the fact that I was there, I wouldn't believe it. Right? I wouldn't believe it if not for the fact that I'd seen it with my own eyes. Right? What's going on? Why is the Talmud telling us about frogs? And what's it got to do with Torah study? Right? So a frog, now there are many explanations. When you get to Agadah, there are many explanations. They were purposely written in a way that each person could get from them whatever his spiritual level allows him. The deeper a person's understanding of Torah, the deeper his understanding, his handle on Kabbalistic secrets, the more he's able to pull out of the Agadic sections of the Gemara, which contain all the Kabbalistic secrets. On a basic level, the Vilna Gaon says that this is an analogy, the Vilna Gaon among other commentaries, this is an analogy for Torah support. A frog, what's unique about a frog? What is a frog? When you think of a frog, everybody knows what a frog does. He croaks nonstop. A frog croaks. The croaking frog is supposed to symbolize the Torah scholar who never stops studying Torah. That he's continuously studying Torah. How big is the frog? The frog is the size of the city of Hagrunya. Hagrunya comes from the Hebrew word garon. Garon means the throat, the sounds that come out of the throat. How big is the city of Hagrunya? 60 buildings. What does 60, number 60 represent? 60 tractates of the Talmud. This frog is the consummate Torah scholar who has mastered the 60 tractates of the Talmud. That means he's mastered the entire Torah. What does the snake always represent? The snake, the Nachash, always represents evil inclination, the Yetzirah. The first foe in history, man's foe, is the Nachash. He's always everywhere you find the Nachash. The Nachash is a symbol for the evil inclination, the Yetzirah. The snake is the evil inclination that tells the Torah scholar, swallows up the Torah scholar. In other words, he's saying to the Torah scholar, you better go out and leave your Torah studies, because after all, how are you going to make a livelihood? Go out and close your Gemara. It's time to go to work. Under certain circumstances, I will elaborate afterwards. I'm not telling everybody to quit your careers and learn Torah. We'll explain later. But the snake is the Yetzer Hara, that somebody who has the potential to sit and study Torah, he starts to worry about where is his livelihood going to come from. The snake swallows him up. He's swallowed by this Yetzer Hara. What's the way to overcome the snake? This bird called a pushkansa is apparently a certain bird which is very cruel to its own children. Right? That means this bird has children, and then the bird doesn't provide food for the children. The children, through their own excrement, the little baby birds, their excrement produces little worms, and the children eat the worms, the little baby birds, right? They eat the worms, and that's how they support themselves. This bird looks at his children and says, the children, I'm not going to provide for you. Right? I'm not going to provide for you. Right? You'll have to worry about it on your own. Where does the bird go? The bird goes and sits on the lands on the tree. Now, you've heard the expression, we say every Shabbos, Eitz Chaim Hila Machazikim Ba, is the tree of life for those who take hold of it. The tree always symbolizes support for the Torah. Right? The tree is the support. Eitz Chaim Hila Machazikim Ba. It is a tree of life for those who take hold of it, for those who hold the Torah, uphold it, and support it. The tree symbolizes Torah support. Say the commentaries. What is the Gemara trying to tell us here? The first, the most powerful Yetzer Hara, when I explain to you about Kolol in a second, you'll understand. The most powerful Yetzer Hara to pull a person away from Torah study. Those of you who missed yesterday, we were speaking about, we emphasized the importance of Torah study. So in light of what we spoke about yesterday, once a person has dedicated himself to studying Torah, the one nagging worry that he constantly has is, where am I going to get support from? So what does the Yetzer Hara do? The Yetzer Hara says to me, you're absolutely right. You better close your Gemara, go out and work. What's the only way to overcome that? The only way to overcome that is develop an attitude which metaphorically, obviously not in reality, but metaphorically the attitude has to be one of cruelty to your own children. As if you'd say to your children, I'm not taking care of it, right? You'll have to find your own support. What will happen to the person who's willing to dedicate himself to Torah study? Such a person will end up finding the tree that's going to support him. If he dedicates himself to his Torah study, HaKadosh Baruch Hu will eventually find the tree that's going to support him, and he will be able to learn his Torah uninterrupted with the support being provided from an outside source. Says Rav Papa, if I hadn't seen it, I wouldn't have believed it. That means Rav Papa was from Babylonia. He was visiting in Eretz Yisrael. In Babylonia, the Torah support system, for some reason, was very weak. It was only when he came to Eretz Yisrael and he saw the Torah support system in Eretz Yisrael, he couldn't believe it. He was shocked, because where he came from, they weren't supporting Torah as liberally. So he came to Eretz Yisrael, he saw the Torah support system in Eretz Yisrael, he said, if I hadn't seen it, I wouldn't have believed it. Right? Now that's what the Gemara is alluding to, and the Gemara talks about a giant frog and a giant snake. Now, nowadays, most of you have heard, and this is very important, if you leave Israel with nothing else except this piece of information, the whole trip will have been worthwhile. All of you have heard of, mostly you've heard of, the idea of kolol, right? Person learning in kolol. Now, you know what a kolol is. A kolol is a group of Torah scholars, or budding Torah scholars, who sit and study Torah exclusively. Their life is dedicated to learning Torah. They receive a stipend, a minimal amount of money, which allows them to get by with their basic necessities. Both the stipend and the fact that their wives may work, or they may have a little money coming in from outside sources. Now, we spoke yesterday about a Yisachar Zevulun relationship, that there are people who, because they feel they want a part in Torah study, but unfortunately they're not able to dedicate themselves to learning, the way they are able to ease their conscience, both in a very real way, they ease their conscience, they feel guilty not learning, plus they are doing what they feel that their purpose is, they support those that will study Torah. So you have in Israel right now, probably, I think the last figure I heard was 20,000 kolel students, right? That means all over the country, you have Jews studying Torah. The way it works is usually a guy goes to yeshiva, and he goes through, when you're coming up, an FFB, somebody who's come up through the system. He goes to day school, goes off to yeshiva, he gets married at around anywhere between 20 and 25 years old. He gets married under normal circumstances. After he gets married, the woman that he marries is usually, she's been through the Beis Yaakov system. The education that she's received, the system tries to brainwash her that she should want a husband who's going to study Torah, right? That she, I use brainwashing in a positive sense, right? That she should, if the success, if the education has been a success, what she should want when she comes out of seminary is that her husband is going to dedicate several years to learning Torah at the beginning of their married life together. Now, if someone is a promising scholar who looks like he can develop into one of the leaders of the generation or into a major rabbi or something big stuff, so he will stay in Kolel for as long as possible, sometimes 10, 15 years. Very often they'll go to Kolel and they will develop into halachic authorities that can rule in a Torah Beis Din, or they can be rabbis of communities, which will depend on the kolel they attend and what they choose to study and how long they study for. No one, very few people, are career kolel people, right? That means that they go to kolel and they stay in kolel for the rest of their lives. It just doesn't happen. Eventually, you have the financial pressures begin to mount. You have to support a family. Very often, it is in part of the makeup of the human being that you need, after a certain amount of time of studying, usually as a person starts hitting 30, this is what I've seen in kolel developing, as a man starts hitting 30, 31, 32, there's a certain psychological need that he feels that he needs to get out from behind the Gemara, from the constant, just only the studying of the Torah. He needs to go out and do something. Now, he could sometimes go out and he could teach, or he could work, whatever it is that he does, he needs to do something other than just sitting and studying exclusively. So it will depend very often on the individual. It will also depend on the financial support. One thing you do not have a right to do, you do not have a right to make a declaration that I am going to Kolel, somebody support me, right? That you're not allowed to do, because you can only take on the responsibility of marriage if you intend to support your family. One of those little annoying realities of life, right? You write in the kesuba is the marriage document, you write that you are going to support your wife. You know that the male has the obligation to support the family. Even if the wife works, she could come home one day and say to her husband, sorry, I just retired, right? And he has no legal, halachic legal recourse whatsoever, because he has no obligation to work. So at a point where finances become a burden, then the husband has an obligation to go out and support his family. So if you're going to learn in Kolel, it can only be done if there is someone, a combination of the Kolel and perhaps your father-in-law or your parents, somebody who's willing to support you to learn in Kolel. So the accusation that the ultra-Orthodox Jews are a bunch of parasites is unfounded, right? Because the idea of parasites, I mean, they're living off one of the silliest things that I hear. This really eats away at me. I've heard a lot of accusations. Most of them kind of bounce off. The one that I really can't stand is when they say, you know, those ultra-Orthodox Jews don't do anything, right? That's just ridiculous. What do you mean they don't do anything? If they're sitting and learning, that is doing something. It may not be what you want them to be doing, but it's ridiculous that they don't do anything. So somebody who's learning in Kolel, it's only if there are other people that find it important enough for him to be learning in Kolel, and therefore there's a group effort to support him. If you do not have the means to learn in Kolel, then you are discouraged from learning in Kolel. So I want that to be very very clear what it is that everybody's doing, why they're learning. Somebody who's not married doesn't have to go to a golo because he can stay in a yeshiva, right? The yeshiva provides his basic needs. But once those he gets married and the realities of life require money, then he has to go find a different arrangement. So a golo means a collective, a gathering, right? A gathering of people, they learn Torah together, and eventually they go out and they join the workforce, okay? Any questions about kolel or Torah study in general? All right, so you're all going to go to kolel.
At what point do students develop would he be eligible to become a member of kolel?
Okay, so the way it used to work in the old days in Europe, the way it used to work is that in every community there was no such thing as kolel. Right. What happened was most people were working people. Only those that were the most promising students, they were the ones where they would get a shidduch. The part of their shidduch arrangement would be that the father-in-law would provide financial support so that they could continue learning uninterrupted. They usually went, they would get married, they would live with the father-in-law. The father-in-law would provide their support, usually would take on an obligation for 5 years. The son-in-law would study Torah uninterrupted, and eventually he would blossom into a halachic authority, and he would become the rabbi of the city. That situation changed after the Jews came back to Israel in the beginning of the state, and the country was starting to develop a very Jewish flavor. What we felt, or what the leading Torah sages felt at the time, there was a need for more Torah scholars to develop. And that in our generation, because, you know, I told you the Rambam says a person could work a certain amount of hours and they could study Torah. According to the Rambam's formula, people could still develop into Torah scholars. Nowadays, the realities of life, you know, your great-grandparents were much tougher than you were, without any doubt. Your great-grandparents had much more stamina, they worked harder, they can bear more pain. I remember when I had my wisdom teeth pulled. My wisdom teeth pulled with Novocaine, with everything. I was out of action for 2 days, right? My wife's grandfather had his wisdom teeth pulled without Novocaine, and he stuffed some cotton in his mouth, and he went straight from the dentist, he went back to work, right? It's something to us, it's unfathomable. How could people bear such pain? In the old days, where people were stronger, they could both work and master Torah. As the generations weakened, the leading sages of the generation realized we need to make it possible for people to study Torah exclusively, to study Torah, to be totally immersed in Torah. Otherwise, we are going to lose Torah leadership because we don't have the strength to be involved in both. Therefore, they encouraged the development of the kolel system, and the kolel system has now become widespread. It's practically basic. Basically, it's what is expected and what is usually done with any yeshiva guy. It's one of the values of the society we live in. Like anything, the system could be abused and misused, and you have people who shouldn't be in kolel, people should really be out working. Like any system, there are always going to be your exceptions. But for the most part, it is a successful system. I told the guys, I think it was in Pirkei Avos here, I once broke my foot. I was in Israel. I had broken my foot. It was during the doctor's strike. Right? There was a doctor's strike at the time, just my mazel. Right? And I broke my foot. And I went to the doctor. The doctor was an American guy. He happened to be from Chicago. Totally non-observant. And we were sitting, and he said to me, "What do you do?" So I said, "Well, you know, I learn in kolel." So he said, "Well, how do you live?" I said, "Well, you know, my wife works. I guess someone has to, huh?" That's what he said to me. Now, had my foot not been in his hand at the time, my broken foot, which he was in the middle of manhandling at the time, had my foot not been in that position, I would have said to him, "You know, you're a jerk. Right? You went to medical school. Right? You spent all those years in medical school. Somebody put you through medical school, right? If you were married, your wife was working while you went to medical school. If not, your parents put you through. Otherwise, you borrowed money. But you didn't work at the time, right? You were studying, and you felt that the studying is important enough, it warrants some type of outside help, right? So you didn't get from your wife. You got from the United States government, right? One way or another, somebody was supporting you through medical school because it was important enough to you, right? I'm learning Ecola because that's an important study to us. It's important enough to me and important enough to my wife that we want to have an arrangement whereby I'm able to learn Torah. That's something that's important to her, and we understand that we have a partnership where she shares the reward like any husband and wife. But I didn't say that because I have my foot in his hands, right? But that is what I would have liked to have said and like to have him understand. So it's important to realize the studying is not purposeless studying. It's studying that we feel is keeping the world in existence. Right? Therefore, there's so much emphasis.
So where in a student's development does what he qualified for Ecola?
So in answer to your question, nowadays, almost all students are provided with the Ecola opportunity, even Baal Tshuvas, who have had very little background. They may have even become Baal Tshuvas after they got married. He's got more financial support. There are Ecolas for Baal Tshuvas, right? There are Ecolas for, it's not in his development. Nowadays, the determining factor for Ecola is when you get married. When you get married, you go to Ecola, right? Before you're married, you can sit in Yeshiva and learn exclusively in Yeshiva. Okay, now, one has to be very honest with himself about his, I was just speaking to somebody about half hour ago. Somebody said to me that I just mentioned to one of the students that I don't foresee a very long kolol curve for him, if any, because he doesn't have the makeup to sit and crack the books for 12 hours a day. Right? When you're in the kolol, you're in the kolol for about 10 hours a day. When you get up in the morning, before you leave the kolol, you're studying Torah. When you come home at night, you have a chavrusa in the home to learn. It's a very intense lifestyle, right? But then again, people are supporting you that you should be totally immersed in Torah. It's like the longer somebody's able to do it, the more he's able to blossom and develop. And each person has to have a mentor to tell him when he should enter kolol, when he should leave. Okay? Yeah.
What if a person is not married, however, he studies in yeshiva and he has no, absolutely no sources of income? Of course, I understand that yeshiva gives him room and board and so, but still, you know, life, in real life, certain expenses are inevitable,
okay.
Minimal expenses. So isn't it that, therefore, wiser that person should go for work before going to yeshiva?
It's a good question. If a person is under such financial stress that he can't concentrate on his studies, then obviously he should close the book and he should go out and work. I once heard Rabbi Gottlieb, he said, Don't confuse faith in God with irresponsibility. That means people very often say, you know, well, I'm going to learn in Kol. What's going to provide for you? Well, the Abishter. Say it in Yiddish, it sounds even better, right? The Abishter, right? I'll talk about Abishter, right? You got to go out and work. You're not some deep, you know, some big believer that all of a sudden you believe that God's going to provide for you, right? If you have a responsible means of support, at that point, then you could believe that God's giving to you. During the Gulf War, right, none of you guys were here when we were under attack by the Iraqis, right? Which is what it sounded like on the radio at the time, right? When we, you know, with hindsight, I shaved my beard at the time, right? I have pictures at home, and if you want to pay, I'll show you. At 2 o'clock in the morning, the sirens went off. This is after the warnings about, you know, it's going to happen. So all the men. I remember in our neighborhood, I kept saying to my wife, oh, forget it, nothing's going to happen, relax, they're not about to shoot missiles at Israel, forget it, don't worry about it. And all the women were very uptight, you know, they made us make the sealed room, which I didn't want to do, right? The radio said, seal off the room with tapes on and so forth. All the women said, oh, forget it, don't worry about it. So I remember the first night of the war, at 2 o'clock, and it was 2 o'clock in the morning, 2, 3 o'clock in the morning in Israel, the radio goes on. I don't remember how we found out that the Americans had attacked. We turned on the radio, and we hear that the United States attacked, and they knocked out those two missile sites. Right. So I looked at my wife. I said, it's all over. Right. Finished. Right. Israel's safe. Right. The next night, about 2 o'clock in the morning, we hear this, and my wife is saying to me the whole time, she says, I don't know, they're a little overconfident, I don't know. I said, relax, girl, take it easy, right? The next night, at about 2 o'clock in the morning, all of a sudden, we hear honking outside our window. We hear honking, we hear shouting. It's very disconcerting at 2 o'clock in the morning when you know there's a war on and you hear honking and shouting, right? So we're like, what's going on? In the meantime, my wife goes into the kitchen, she turns on the radio, and I'm sitting there listening out the window. I didn't know exactly what was going on. As I start walking towards my wife is coming, she's going like that, pointing to the room, right? to the sealed room, right? So we had our infant son at the time. You haven't lived until you've put your infant son in a tent to protect him from gas attack, right? That's just one of life's great experiences. So we go back into our sealed room. This is the first night at a warm center. We have a radio in the room. We have provided a radio and everything. And at 2 o'clock in the morning, I'm trying to put a gas mask on. I remember when I went to pick up, there was a fight with my wife. Should I even pick up the gas? And I said, come on, what are you doing with gas mask? I got a schlep for the family. I'm taking this gas mask, this darn thing, and I'm trying to put it over. I put it over my beard, and I feel that I can breathe. I'm not supposed to be able to get any air from underneath over here. So I immediately went into the bathroom, and I shaved my beard off, right? Here I was, you know, shaving. Then we go into the sealed room. We sat there for the first night, I think 3 hours, until they finally said all is clear. You know, it was a state of panic, because you thought you're under the way it sounded on Israeli radio. They said, in Hebrew, it sounds a lot worse than anything. They said, everybody in your sealed room due to Iraqi missile attack, right? In Hebrew, it sounds like you don't know what's happening. There are missiles falling out of the sky. So we're in the sealed room, and eventually everything calmed down. We came to the yeshiva, so there were sealed rooms here in the yeshiva. And the guys in the yeshiva were told that whenever the siren goes off, they have to go into the sealed room. So one of the guys at the yeshiva, the reason I brought this up, one of the guys at the yeshiva asked me, when the sirens go off, instead of going to his sealed room, can he go to the base medrash? Right? He'll go to the base medrash. Instead of going to the sealed room, he'll run to the base medrash. So I said to him, let me tell you something. If you run to the base medrash, and you know, you go to the base medrash, and you probably grab the Aron Kodesh and hold it for dear life, right? And then nothing happens to you, why will you assume nothing happened to you? Obviously, God was protecting you. Your job is to go to your room and realize that in your room, it's God that's protecting you. Right? For a person to say they have faith in God, they have belief in God, God will provide. Our job isn't to sit here, God will provide, and just wait for the wallet to fall on the desk. It's not going to happen. Our job and our level is to go to work. And after we're working, and we put all our energies into our job, then to realize that in spite of our efforts, God has provided for us. You have no right to be, I'm a man of faith. Yeah, what are you doing in that hammock? I'm a man of faith, right? I don't work. I lie in a hammock 8 hours a day, right? Because I'm a man of faith. That's not a man of faith. That's a man of stupidity. Because you're going to be a very hungry hammock hanger, right? Because nobody is going to provide for you. Just because you say you believe in God, God's not going to provide it for you, right? So it has to be done. The whole kolal attitude, the whole package has to be done with a certain sense of responsibility. I told you then that if you get married, when you get married, the first and most important ingredient in taking on the responsibility of marriage, everybody says, you know, I'm not ready for marriage, right? I'm not ready for marriage right now. I'm just emotionally not ready. Well, I got news for you. There is the only thing that gets you ready for marriage is marriage itself, right? There's no getting ready. You can take all the marriage courses that you want. Once you get married, surprise, right? It's completely different than anything you could have imagined. So the only way to get ready emotionally for marriage is through marriage itself. But one ingredient that you must have, one factor you must have in order not to subject your life's partner to a life of misery, you must be responsible. So if you're responsible but selfish, go ahead and get married, right? Your wife will take care of the selfishness. If you're not selfish, you're the most giving person in the world, but you're irresponsible, don't get married. Because at that point, you have no right to subject her to your irresponsibility. That's the one factor you must have conquered in order to get married. Okay? Now, any other questions? Okay, speaking of marriage.
Yeah.
We're going to go on to the next mitzvah. The next mitzvah is the sota. Now, the sota is the... I don't have a handout on this. I'll hopefully give you the handout before the end of the program. The sota is the wife in the Torah. She's the woman who has... I think everybody knows she's the woman who drinks. She drinks the drink that tests to see whether she has been unfaithful to her husband or not. It's in the Torah portion of Nusso in the book of Bamidbar, in Numbers. Now, the word sota means, it's closely related to listot, means to stray. A sota is a woman that has strayed. Now, the Torah describes the following situation. A man goes over to his wife and he says to his wife, I'm warning you, I am issuing a warning, you must not seclude yourself with a certain man. And he must name the man by name. You must not seclude yourself, we'll call him Bernie. You must not seclude yourself with Bernie. If you seclude yourself with Bernie behind locked doors, and there are witnesses that saw the character, and then she actually goes and she is behind locked doors with this man. Right? Now, what does the husband do? At that point that she has secluded herself with this other man, she is forbidden to resume her relationship with her husband until we ascertain whether or not she is innocent or guilty. From this point on, they are not allowed to live together. That's why the halacha is, nowadays, a man must not say to his wife, the halacha says a man must not say to his wife, do not seclude yourself with so-and-so. Because if she goes against his warning nowadays, and she secludes herself with Bernie, then she becomes prohibited to her husband forever. Because we do not have a base of Mikdash nowadays, we have no way of giving her the mystical drink. Therefore, if a husband warns his wife about a certain individual, and then she does it, then their marriage is, for all intents and purposes, over. Okay? Hold the question. I'll take the question a little while there. Okay? Now, he brings her to the base of Mikdash. One of the things he does is he brings a sacrifice for her. There's an offering. It's called the meal offering. The meal offering is barley, right? They bring barley, and usually the offering that the meal offerings in the Beis Hamikdash were usually made out of wheat, because wheat is human food. Who normally eats barley? You feed barley to animals, right? The Gemara says her sacrifice, the sacrifice to symbolize the sota, is barley because her behavior was animal-like. She behaved like an animal. Therefore, her sacrifice is animal sacrifice. Now, the obvious question is, but she hasn't been proven guilty yet. Right? Why?
Please turn the tape to the other side.